Albert Einstein, who was a true genius. You know that the word genius means guardian spirit. That incredible mind that was guided and directed by its inner genie said, I see a pattern, but my imagination cannot picture the maker of that pattern. I see the clock, but I cannot envision the clockmaker. The human mind is unable to conceive of the fourth dimension. How can it conceive of a God, therefore, before whom 1,000 years and 1,000 dimensions are as one? If a mind like Einstein acknowledges the incredible difficulty that we have in becoming aware of seeing, of relating to that which is invisible, then you can imagine the problem that persons with lesser insight must have. As a matter of fact, to cross this mental and spiritual bridge is the most important part of the journey that we're making, I believe, here in this lifetime, in this experience. And for this reason, I believe that the Lord's Prayer is one of the most incredible gifts that has been given to mankind. Now, like so many gifts, it has no value if we do not understand it, if we do not comprehend the significance of that gift. How can a key unlock a door if you don't know that you have a door, or that there is a lock, or that there is a key, or that there is some place to go once the door is opened? You will think, what is this strange thing I hold in my hand? And sometimes we have, I'm sure, recited and prayed the Lord's Prayer without understanding that it is a master's key that has been designed to help us unlock the door so that we might move upward that pathway toward higher consciousness, toward our larger Christ identity. First of all, let's remember that Jesus Christ clearly demonstrated that God is experienceable by a person. And not just by one person himself. He proved by his daily life that it was possible to maintain a conscious contact with God. And he showed by the many marvelous works that he did, and those works were sometimes called miracles, that the activity of God could be demonstrated in the lives of ordinary people. And he not only proved that through his understanding that he could cause events, life-shaping, life-changing events to take place in the life of another person, but what was even more remarkable, he taught other people how to have the experiences that he did. Never, ever did he indicate that what was known to him was his information alone. Quite the opposite. It was very important to him to teach other persons the understanding that made it possible for him to experience and to demonstrate the things that that made him such an incredible prototype person. He taught many people how to establish their own conscious relationship with God and established a system that would make this possible for every person. And I believe that the Lord's Prayer is the Jesus Christ system condensed to its essence, brought down to its smallest common denominators. And the 7 phases or steps of the Lord's Prayer are the Jesus Christ system in a progressive form. The supreme example of true prayer is the Lord's Prayer. And it's interesting that Jesus chose the reverent term, Our Father, but it was more than a reverent term. Remember last week in our lesson, we became aware that he was using a metaphor, meaning a parable. He was using that term, our Father, to clearly establish the parent-child relationship that can exist between God and any person. And it's a relationship that makes all people brothers and sisters or siblings. Jesus expands upon the nature of that perfect parent that he called Father. And remember that he lived in a patriarchal society, which meant that he would have had great difficulty establishing God as being feminine also in nature. And yet, the way that he brought that symbology to our attention clearly established the warm, loving, beautiful, healing, responsive qualities that we have identified as our own feminine nature. So our Father is really much, much more than we have conceived our Father to be. Our Father is an infinite power and an infinite intelligence, present everywhere and exquisitely, lovingly responsive to the slightest attention that a person might give to it. It's interesting also that Jesus chose to use another word. He called God Abba, which, if we could properly translate it into English, would mean daddy. Isn't that something? That warm, friendly, small child's tender parent relationship. That's exactly what he was saying to us. Our Father is the creator of all things, both visible and invisible, the creator of the universe that we see and the universe that is beyond our seeing, the creator that is capable of the most exquisitely personal responses to the created. And you and I are the created. The creator is like a perfect parent. And our relationship with our perfect parent should be that of a child who has access to that parent and should be able to experience all that the parent has or is or is capable of giving. And in like manner, the parent should have access to the child. Perfect relationship between parent and child, the creator, the created. Jesus taught and proved that the God of the universe, the infinite presence, is very personal and very loving, very responsive. Now, having shown that God and people are parent and child, he goes on in the Lord's Prayer to delineate the function of each. Remember, in the first movement, we have established the nature of the relationship. And now, in the second phase, we come to the function that each has in that relationship. He explains that it is the nature of God to be in heaven and of men to be on earth. And at first thought, we believed that that meant that God was somewhere off in the sky and we were consigned to live here alone and separated upon this planet, because obviously earth means the planet, doesn't it? And the heavens mean out there somewhere. Our Father, who is in heaven. Therefore, if we could locate heaven, we've located God, right? As a matter of fact, all of the great religions have had their heaven by some name. And always, the common denominator of heaven is the presence of God. Is that not well defined in your own mind. Have we not always known that heaven is where God is? Heaven is where God is. Well, if God is spirit, then heaven is everywhere. So heaven must therefore not be a place. If we are to find heaven, we, in our search, must not seek it as a place, some distant place. Among its meanings, the word heaven has been defined as firmament, sky, and the abode of bliss. And Jesus said, if you search for him, lo here and lo there, you will not find him until you seek him within yourself. And so he said the kingdom of heaven is to be located in each, or to be found in each person. Interesting. The kingdom of heaven, or of the heavens, therefore, is a state of consciousness in which the human mind is in harmony with infinite intelligence. So heaven is not a place. Heaven is a state of mind. And I can assure you that to accept this understanding is one of the most difficult actions that the human mind can undertake. Jesus evidently experienced this like difficulty in making himself understood, and I'm sure this accounts for the numerous parables and comparisons that he gave of the kingdom. He was constantly talking about the kingdom of the heavens or the kingdom of God, which really is the same designation. He gave many, many parables, and a parable is a story that you use about something that is familiar, something that you know quite a bit about, but it is a story used to explain something that has not yet been fully grasped or understood. We do this with children all the time. We use parables or fairy tales or examples of something that a child understands in order to convey a message that is beyond the child's wisdom at the moment. These parables were all illustrative of some condition pertaining to the kingdom, and never did he describe it as a place located in some distant realm. He said it was within you. Now, I'm sure that if it was some other place and he knew about it, he would have given instructions about that place and perhaps about how to find it in some other part of the universe. But he said quite the opposite. It is in you, and for example, in the 13th chapter of Matthew, he gives six different stories concerning this condition and our relationship to it. If we apply some of the laws of the mind as we know them, we find that Jesus was talking about universal laws and the expression of these laws in the human mind through the human condition. He was talking about us, each one of us, and how we were to have this experience. One of the things that was clearly understood is that everything has a cause and an effect. You cannot separate cause from effect. Therefore, heaven stands for God, or first cause, and earth stands for the effect. Heaven is the abode, if you will, of God, from whom all blessings flow. Heaven is the source of our good. Heaven could be defined, perhaps, as the mind of God existing everywhere, but most particularly in each of us. And anyone who enters into, or has, or perceives, or comes to be touched by this heavenly state of mind immediately has a conscious contact and experience of or with God. And so, therefore, heaven is to be sought above all else. We have been shown that in our ordinary state of mind, we live in and deal with and have come to believe in the world of effects. You see, causes are always invisible. Effects are invariably visible. For example, you may see a sculptor at work and behold the glorious creation that becomes visible to the eye. You see the sculptor, but you do not see the mind, the incredible creative ability of that sculptor that brings that exquisite creation into existence. True of a painter or a musical artist. Mind is always the cause, the creative mind that is present in a person, and the effect is visible. What does this have to do with you and me? We have come to be so enamored by the world of effects that we have identified ourselves with effects and lost our ability to be aware of or to establish our conscious relationship with the world of cause, the world of spirit, the invisible world from which all things are formed. Cause is invisible. God is invisible. Have you seen God with the eye? Well, yes, I have, but no, I haven't. I have seen the things that God has done. Look at the firmament. We've been told to look at the heavens and behold there the mighty works that God has done. And Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. But the Father is greater than I. The paradox. And the things that I do not do them. I cannot possibly do these things of myself. I am powerless. But a presence inside me that you cannot see has done these things. But if you see what God has done, then you have in a certain way seen the one who has done it. So, let's think of heaven as the term for the presence of God, and heaven as being in each of us, and begin to see now that our destiny as individuals is to draw forth or to call forth or to become aware of this kingdom of the heavens that is within us, to begin to see some things that we have not seen before, and to be aware that the world around us, the world of effects, is but an expression of the activity of cause. Emmett Fox, who was a mystic, wrote, since it is misunderstandings about the relationship of God and man that lead to all our difficulties, it is worth any amount of trouble correctly to understand that relationship. Trying to have manifestation without cause is atheism, and we know where that leads. Trying to have cause without manifestation leads man to suppose himself to be a personal God, and this commonly ends in a kind of paralysis of expression. And that's what the intellect eventually ends up doing. It believes itself to be its own cause, its own first action. And it cannot conceive of anything that might have come before it. And even when it turns to God, it does just for a little help, not very much, because, you know, I can really do most of it, God, if you're there at all. Just give me a little nudge, and once I get started, then I'm on my own again, and everything will be okay. Right? Wrong. In the Lord's Prayer, we're making this transition now from the mind that beholds the effects, believes in the effects, is locked into the effects, is frightened by the effects, and has forgotten the source. Forgotten, yes. We have only vague memories of other possibilities. Fox continued, the important thing to realize is that God is in heaven and man on earth, and that each has his own role in the scheme of things. Although they are one, they are not one and the same. Jesus establishes this point carefully and perfectly when he says, our Father, which art in heaven. Our Father, who is within us and all around us and whose divine perfection is there. Our Father, the invisible because of all that I have seen or experienced is not in some distant place, but is within me. I found you there within me. And then he gives us the third step, very important step, in the direction of our higher understanding. And that step is spoken in the Lord's Prayer, is hallowed be thy name. Hallowed. Obviously a very, very religious word. Right? Wrong. Hallowed, when you just hear it, it makes you sort of want to fall down on your knees and feel a sense of separation, doesn't it? Hallowed be thy name. How many times have you repeated or prayed the Lord's Prayer, never ever knowing what hallowed meant? Well, let's first begin with name. In the Bible, as elsewhere, the word name means the essential nature or character of that thing. And therefore, the name of God is not God. That's not God's name, not in the Bible. The name of God is the essential character of God, or the nature of God. And since the nature of God is infinite, the mind of man cannot conceive of that nature. And so the Hebrews, the Jews of old, were very wise in understanding this. They gave God a name that was a wonderful name. You couldn't speak it. You couldn't say it. So if you couldn't say it, you couldn't get confused. You couldn't believe that that was what God was. Because no matter what name you gave God, God is more than the name. And you know how we tend to get locked into words and phrases? For example, we think we know what love is because we can say it. And we hardly know what love is at all. The word Jehovah that has been used in the Scriptures did not really exist in ancient times. It was never a word at all that was used by the Hebrews. Jehovah is a medieval mistaken translation. The ancients used the divine name of God, which was a tetragrammaton, or a four-letter, a word of four consonants, YHWH. It's very important to know also that the YH represented the masculine identity, and WH was feminine. And so the Hebrews were aware of the masculine, feminine nature of God, YHWH. In the medieval times, that word was given some vowels, and the Y was changed to a J, the vowels were added, and the word became Jehovah. A name that the Hebrews never heard of. And this was because that some people wanted to give God a name that could be spoken. If you used all of the positive nouns known to all of the languages on earth, you could not summon enough words to describe or to define the nature of God. You would have to use such words as life, love, intelligence, power, strength, imagination, zeal, beauty, joy, peace, and on into infinity. But God would be more than all of them. Whatever the name of the real nature of God is, it is. God says, I am. I just am. All that I am is. And one very important example when he was trying to get this message across to people like us was when he sent Moses into Israel and told Moses to tell his people. You know, Moses said, they won't believe me. And God said, tell them that I have sent you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. I am who I am, or I am what I am, or I will be what I will be. And then God said a remarkable thing. Tell the people of Israel that I am has sent me to you. And he was saying to Moses, tell them that you are what I am. Isn't that incredible? Go and tell the people that you are what I am, that I am has sent you to them. And I will prove to them that you are what I am because of the mighty things that you will be able to do. And Moses said, I can't do any of those things. And God said, go, Moses, and I will show you that I am. And Moses went, and everything that God said would happen, happened. But it happened in the mind, in the life, in the experience of Moses. Now, here's a very interesting fact. The word Moses means drawing out or extracting. And it comes in its first phase in the fact that Moses, as you know, was set adrift on the water so that he could be discovered and cared for by the Pharaoh's daughter. And so he was drawn out of the water. But Moses means more than that. It means the drawing out or the extracting of the qualities of God that are within ourselves. And so the Moses consciousness represents that state of development that is unquestionably taking place in you right now, in which you draw out or you extract or you call forth in yourself that which God is in you. Isn't that remarkable? When we're told what the name of God is, we're told what his nature is, and his name or nature is hallowed. Hallowed where? Well, in Moses, obviously in Jesus, but how about you and me? If we will take the word hallowed back to its derivation into the Old English, we will discover a most extraordinary and interesting fact. The word hallowed has the same meaning as holy or whole or wholesome or heal or healed. It really means I am all there is. I'm the whole thing. God is saying I am all of it. Everything that there is, I am. Everything that has ever been expressed has come from me. It is an expression of me. It means wholeness. But to hallow is to recognize as being whole. Yes, God has said that God is whole, but the instruction is that we shall hallow his nature. And that means to recognize his nature. It means to rejoice in his nature. It means to observe it. It means to become aware of it. It means to identify with it. It means to begin to believe in it. It means to call it forth. It means to express it. It means to draw it out. It means to stop seeing the problems and start beholding the creative cause. When you and I get caught up in a massive form of misery, is there anybody that's ever been caught up in massive misery? Is that hallowing the name of God, the nature of God? No, that's believing in the nature of problems. And in that moment, we have come to believe that life is for problems. We are looking at and observing and identifying with and rejoicing negatively in the world of problems. So here is this great teacher saying, hallowed be your nature. Become aware of your nature. Honor your nature. See it. It's to come to believe that a rose bush cannot produce lilies. So God cannot cause or send anything but perfect good to God's beloved children. It's to begin to believe in serendipity. It's to begin to believe that all things are working together for the good of those who have hallowed or who have begun to adore or to believe in the nature of God is their one experience. To see themselves as an expression of the one power and to know that it simply does not matter what happens to us. that we're going to rejoice in the experience that is back of what has seemed to be visible to us. Hallowed be thy name means that your nature is altogether good. You are the author of that perfect good, and I will believe in it. I will rejoice in it. I will expect the good that's coming to me in the face of what appears to be irrefutable forces working against me. I will believe in you when all else seems to have failed. I will believe in you. I will never believe in the appearances. This does not mean that I will not make certain adjustments of the moment, because surely the tire on my car went flat. Surely the problem in my body really exists, and it was diagnosed. But in whom do I believe? I believe in my life. I believe that my life itself is the expression of God, that you are not off in some other part of the sky, but that you are the essence of me pouring yourself forth. And I will honor you with my rejoicing, that everyone that beholds me this day will have seen you. They who see me will have seen the Father. Hallowed be your name means that I realize that your true nature is my real identity, and that my very life and the love that I'm feeling and the intelligence with which I perceive the world around me and the power that is mine to move my finger, the strength to accomplish the things that I need to accomplish, all these things are but an expression of you. The word realize means to make real. I will realize the reality of your being by establishing you in my own consciousness. And in time, my belief will become visible. My belief becomes a new cause. It becomes a first cause. My invisible belief in the presence of God becomes the cause of the new chain of events that will be seen in the world of my fellows. I will honor you and not my problems. I will honor you by being like you to the best of my ability to be like you today, and tomorrow I will be more like you, and the following day I will be yet more like you, because each day I will practice, I will reach beyond my ability of this day, and you will empower me, because you are the source of my power. You are my Father. You are that beloved presence from whom all blessings flow. And you know that I am fitting myself to be of maximum service to you and to the people around me. I honor you, and therefore you must honor me. That is our relationship. As I give myself to you, my beloved parent, so do you give yourself to me. Many years ago, when I first discovered that God was experienceable, I became aware of and experienced God in some very important areas of my life, and I cannot tell you, I do not have the words to tell you how exquisite was that awakening for me. I lived on a new planet. This was a new world. I discovered trees when I was 29, and people, and love, and popcorn, and all kinds of wonderful things. My life came alive. I had been one of the living dead, and suddenly I was alive. And yet I knew that the life that I was experiencing was just a breath, that there was more than that and more beyond. Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul, as the swift seasons roll. I knew that was my responsibility, that I had only touched the hem of the garment of the consciousness that Jesus has and that he was teaching us about and helping us to experience through the system of thought that the Lord's Prayer incorporates. Now, even as I was experiencing glorious moments here you must know that there were some still darkened areas of my life. There were some rooms in my house of consciousness in which the lights had not yet been turned on. Do you understand what I'm saying? I thought you would. And as I went out in my days and into my nights, I have had moments of glorious ecstasy, followed by other moments in which I was plunged into darkness and depression and had to struggle like you would if you were going over Niagara Falls, trying to not go over the brink. And in the city of my birth, where I lived at the time, I had two very important locations that I would take myself to in such moments so that I could practice the presence of God. One was on a high point within the city limits, Mill Mountain. It took several minutes to drive up the mountain, so that was where I went at night to meditate and to look out over that place where I lived. Another place was on Roanoke River. There was a city park not too far from where I was most times, and I found a place that I would park along the river bank where the soothing sound of the water flowing over the rocks could sometimes help me to find my peace while I took charge of that part or that corner of my mind. And one day when I was worrying about something that I can no longer remember, I found myself parked beside the river. And as I sat there, striving to not be concerned or worried or frightened, I became aware that just off to my left, perhaps 200 feet away, there was a man digging a ditch. And so I listened to the sound of the water coming over the rocks while I sat with my attention focused on the man digging the ditch. I could see the tip of his shovel come up out of the ditch and dirt would be tossed off to one side and more shovels of dirt which accumulated along the bank, and there would be a pause, and then the tip of a pick would come up out of the hole and it would descend into the hole and several strokes of the pick, and then there would be a long pause, and I could envision him resting on the shovel, and then more dirt would come out, and I watched a man dig a ditch. And suddenly I became aware. I had not seen a man at all. He was in the ditch. He was invisible to me. I had only seen the effect of him. He was the cause, and certainly the dirt came out of the ditch, and there was the tip of the shovel, and that shovel was not in its own hand. And I put my car in gear and drove away. I did not want to see him, the person. It made me aware that all my life I had been beholding God in the world around me and did not know it. I thought I saw a man digging a ditch. It's true, I saw a ditch being dug. But the cause of that ditch being dug was invisible to me. I have seen God when I behold you. You are an effect. Your creator is the cause. But you are an effect that lives, and so therefore the life that is in you must be the life of your creator. Cause and effect must always be one. Isn't that what Jesus said? If you have seen me, if you've seen my works, you have seen the Father in action. I do not do these things. I can tell you that I do not live this life. And when you and I begin to hallow the nature of God, when we begin to become aware that it is the life of God, the Spirit of God, that is our own self experiencing itself in that a moment Just a moment of awareness, a moment of consciousness, one moment of practicing the presence of God, beholding the glory of God, can change your life forever. This is the stuff of miracles. It's what Jesus said. It's the source of miracles. To be in that place where you see that you are but the channel, you are but the agent, you are but the hand. The Egyptians understood this. Almost all of the ancient religions have. Primitive people understand far more than we sophisticated modern intellectuals. They've seen themselves and known themselves to be but the extensions of a mighty force. And they knew that as they called upon it, that they would be empowered to do incredible things and to understand with a higher wisdom than their own. That really is what hallowed be thy name really means. It means that I am here and I behold you in all things, most particularly in these things that I have to do. I go out to live this day, and I will live it well, because whatever happens, you are with me. And I will experience your glory and your wisdom. You will take me by the hand, and I will be led to my destined place. I'll be at the right place at the right time to have the experiences that you have designed for me, but wait a moment, I will recognize it. I will behold it. I will praise you. I will give thanks. And that's what hallowing really means. How does it make you feel when someone becomes aware of you and something that you have just done that is out of the ordinary? How does it make you feel? Hallowed, I would say. Good. Something happens, doesn't it? Something happens. And something happens between God and man, between the Creator and the created, when the created becomes aware and loves and rejoices and gives thanks. Life never stops presenting you with situations or conditions or challenges. But how do you approach them? How do you meet them? How do you solve them? By yourselves? Of yourselves? Then you're trying to hallow yourself. You're trying to praise yourself. You're trying to give glory to yourself, to the ego. And that's where problems arise. But in the midst of the challenges, and they shall always be here upon this planet, in the midst of them, do you remember who you are? Do you remember that you are a spiritual being living in a spiritual universe, and that you are empowered from on high, and that it does not matter what is happening, you will not lose your joy? That you will truly live this day as if it was your last. If it should be your last, it'll be your most glorious day, and you will be remembered as one who loved the Lord because you loved your life. How can you love the Lord if you don't love your life? Because the Lord is your life, expressing. The Lord is not off in some kingdom 4 billion light years from here. You will not find God if you look through a telescope. Look into the mirror, and you will behold a presence looking back. My eyes behold the glory, the coming of the Lord, of the activity of God in so many ways. And you are that way. If I see you, I have seen our Father. Hallowed or glorified is God's nature in you. You are nature's greatest miracle. That's the way it really is.